This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Friday, we'll bring you the story behind one of the world's most famous photographs. For years, it helped shape the negative image of Americans in Vietnam, but it turns out to have been completely misunderstood for decades.
Everything I thought I knew about that photograph turned out to be wrong. The people on the stairs, I thought, were mostly Americans and a few Vietnamese who worked at the embassy, but they weren't. And so instead of a terrible humiliation, which it was for the United States, but there were moments of great courage.
But first today, Federal Minister Darren Chester has flagged his support for paying volunteer firefighters who work for extended periods. His comments increase the pressure on the government to do more to assist volunteers who've already been battling blazes across the country for months, with the dangerous conditions set to continue. Political reporter Claudia Long has more.
It may be the festive season, but for many of the nation's fireys, this week has been far from a holiday. And with blazes continuing to rage across the country, the end of the fire season is far from sight. But for public servants volunteering on the fire ground, there was some welcome news earlier in the week.
I issued a directive to all Commonwealth departments and agencies that will see the full paid leave for emergency services be lifted to a minimum standard of 4 weeks.
The Prime Minister's announcement of more paid volunteer leave for Commonwealth employees came on Christmas Eve, after weeks of pressure on the government to do more for volunteers. But opposition leader Anthony Albanese says it's still not enough because it doesn't cover everyone.
I once again say to the government that they really need to give consideration to providing some form of financial compensation to people who've been putting in defending their local communities and making a difference to our country.
And now it looks like the opposition could have at least one government frontbencher backing their call.
Expecting them to take away, you know, all those weeks and months to be on the fire grounds side by side with state government employees who are being paid, I think in the longer term we need to have this conversation.
On News Breakfast, Minister for Veterans and Defence Personnel Darren Chester added his voice to calls for volunteer firefighters to be paid. He suggested that the cost could be covered by an additional small property-based levy and is now consulting with his community in Victoria's Gippsland region to see what they think.
I'd say about 90-95% are quite supportive of that approach. There's certainly people who are saying, no way, forget about it, mate, you're on the wrong track. But I think it's a conversation that I need to have with my community.
The topic of pay for volunteers has been a dicey one over the last few weeks. But Mr Chester says he isn't trying to pick a fight with the Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister has said that having leave for APS employees extended to 20 days is vital. I'm talking about not paying volunteers for every time they turn out. We're talking about when they get associated with long-term campaign events. I mean, state government employees are out there side by side holding hoses with our CFA volunteers. One's getting paid, one's not.
Opposition leader Anthony Albanese has backed him up.
If you are a small business, a contractor, a private sector worker, and you have not been able to earn an income for a period of months, common sense tells you that is not sustainable, and it's time for a bit of common sense here.
The Minister for Natural Disaster and Emergency Management, David Littleproud, was not available to respond to Mr Chester's comments. But a spokesperson for the Minister told The World Today in a statement that managing the fire services is a matter for the states.
It is up to state governments whether or not they provide payments, whether that's attendance allowances, meal allowances, overnight allowances and the like, to any volunteer firefighter within their jurisdiction.
Minister Darren Chester plans to present his suggestions to the government party room next year, once he's done consulting his constituents. And he says there's a few people in the party room who already have the issue on their minds.
Some of my colleagues, the National Party colleagues, have raised similar concerns with me, and they've suggested that for them, the ageing nature of the volunteer workforce is making it difficult to maintain their volunteer branches or brigades.
Darren Chester is the Minister for Veterans and Defence Personnel. Claudia Long reporting. Health professionals call them the silent killers. Heat waves take more lives than the national road toll. And with a massive heat wave forecast for Australia's southeast tomorrow, Felicity Ogilvie has been finding out how our most vulnerable citizens will cope.
As the heat intensifies in South Australia, the Red Cross is taking to the phones this weekend to check on the elderly. 900 people have signed up to the Red Cross telephone service. Most are older and living alone. The State Manager of Emergency Services, Jai O'Toole, says volunteers will be calling to check on people throughout the day.
If they're saying that they're feeling unwell, We'll either try to get an emergency contact over there, or in more extreme cases, we'll call an ambulance.
Why is it so important that the Red Cross has this service? What would happen if your volunteers weren't calling people to check on them?
Nearly every time we're activated for this service, we end up having to call ambulances for a small number of people who aren't well and getting them medical support. And we've found people unconscious in their homes before, and they've been able to get medical support and have survived. So we genuinely feel that this service does save lives.
The temperature is forecast to reach 40 degrees in Adelaide today and will hover in the high 30s until Tuesday. The same heat wave is moving across Tasmania, Victoria, the ACT and New South Wales. Health experts say that heat waves kill more Australians than natural disasters or car crashes, with the heat often exacerbating medical conditions. Sharon Campbell researches heat waves at the Menzies Institute in Hobart.
The folks that actually die or suffer in heat waves tend to be people that are elderly. They tend to be people that already have significant medical conditions. They tend to be homeless people, people with low economic stability, so poorer folks tend to die more in these conditions. It's all these people that don't have great advocacy. And so heat waves are called the silent killer because the folks that are suffering during these events aren't folks that are readily seen in the media, if you like.
In Victoria, more than 650 elderly people who used to be homeless are being cared for by Winchingham Aged Care. Brian Lipman established the not-for-profit aged care homes.
It's much what you would do if your mum was living with you. You would be trying to keep her hydrated. You'd be trying to keep her calm and plenty of fluids, like hydration. You'd need, we can use things like sponges on the forehead and arms, IsoPol sticks, air conditioning if they've got it.
In Sydney, Mission Australia is sending workers out on the streets to offer water, sunscreen and transport to people who are homeless. In South Australia, a code red has been activated. That means that homeless shelters will be open for longer, providing a cool place for people who don't have a home to get out of the heat.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. There's been a positive development in the deadly measles outbreak in Samoa this week, with vaccination levels now reaching the required 95%. But with the very high number of children under five being killed by the disease, the country is still deep in trauma. And the head of the Australian Medical Assistance Team says experienced members of his staff are finding this the most harrowing mission that they've been on. Dr. Brian Spain has been speaking to Sarah Sedgie.
On Christmas Eve, 95% of the eligible population were vaccinated, which was the target for herd immunity. How significant is this in your efforts to stop the spread of measles?
Look, it's very substantial to stop the new cases coming into the hospital, and we're seeing the clinical effect of that now with reduced numbers of people presenting to the hospitals.
And what sort of support have you and your team been providing?
So the Australian Medical Assistance Teams had two core functions. One of them is in the provision of clinical care to the patients, particularly critical care. So we've brought over intensive care specialists, paediatric emergency physicians and intensive care specialists who have a particular expertise in caring for small children, as well as large numbers of critical care nurses who work in the intensive care, the high dependency areas and in the emergency departments. But we also brought across a public health team who could work with the public health team here in managing the bringing the measles epidemic under control from a public health perspective, planning the immunisation programs and also planning the aftercare for the large number of people who have been affected by measles.
And so the doctors and nurses and health specialists were all working right through Christmas. You would have been there on Christmas Day. How did you spend the day?
Yeah, we've committed. We've been working alongside supporting the Samoan doctors and nurses through the whole thing. And our teams have been here, we've been here for a total of eight weeks on rotations, but the Samoans have been working all of that time and longer. And so we really wanted to make sure that they got a break to be with their families. So we were rostering our staff so that we could work throughout the Christmas period to give the Samoans a bit of rest, but we also managed to have some time for celebration for our team. So we actually had a Christmas dinner in two shifts so that the the people who were going on to night shift had dinner a little bit earlier, and then the rest of the group had it a little bit later. So we managed to have some Christmas festivity up here, despite the tragedy that's been going on for so many weeks with disease and death of many people.
And the biggest tragedy in this is that it disproportionately is affecting very young children.
Yeah, that's correct. The majority of those affected were small children. There's been 5,600 patients across the country, and over 1,800 of those have required admission to hospital, and the vast majority of them have been children, and in particular children under four, so really small children that have been affected.
And what has that been like for health workers to witness, particularly given this disease is preventable?
It's actually been really, really tough. We bring along very experienced professional staff, and every single one of them has told me that they've never seen anything like it in their professional careers. So they've, whilst they've maintained their excellent standard of care and professional attitude, they have certainly told me how harrowing it was, and have found it really tough to see these young children and the effect it's had on the all of the families around them. So it's certainly been a very difficult and challenging mission. Even our most experienced members and leaders have said it's the most difficult mission that they've ever done.
And back in 2013, the country had quite a strong vaccination rate, but then in the years up until 2018, that dropped right down to 30%. What do you think the lesson in all this is?
Look, I think the lesson is for everyone that the importance of maintaining vaccination programs, that it's easy for us to be complacent when we don't see measles very often. And then we realise when you see an epidemic like this, you realise why it's so important. It's just so important for our beloved children, but also for our whole communities, that we maintain those high levels of immunisation, so that when the sporadic cases occur, that they don't end up turning into an epidemic like we've seen in Samoa.
That's Dr. Brian Spain from the Australian Medical Assistance Team to Samoa, speaking to Sarah Sedgi. This is The World Today. Well, now to our story about how one photograph that helped shape the negative image of Americans in Vietnam turned out to have been completely misunderstood for decades. The Vietnam War has long been regarded in the West as a talisman of dishonour and disgrace for the United States and its allies. But historian Thurston Clark's latest book, Honourable Exit, shifts that view, at least in part. Thurston Clark joined me from New York when his book was launched in June. Thurston Clark, thanks so much for joining The World Today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, you start your book with perhaps one of the most famous photographs of the last half century. First, can you describe that photograph for us and explain what it's traditionally symbolised about the US in Vietnam?
Yes, of course. It's the photograph of people climbing a ladder to get to the top of a building. There's a man in a white shirt who's reaching down to help people aboard the helicopter. Now, when that was first sent out, the building was misidentified as the U.S. Embassy. And most people, when they saw that photograph, thought, oh, this is the Americans escaping from their own embassy. And it kind of fit into the narrative of the end of the Vietnam War being a terrible humiliation for the United States.
So when you found out more about the true details in that photo, what did you think that it actually shows?
Everything I thought I knew about that photograph turned out to be wrong. First of all, it wasn't the embassy. The people on the stairs, I thought, were mostly Americans and a few Vietnamese who worked at the embassy. But they weren't. They were all Vietnamese. And so instead of a terrible humiliation, which it was for the United States, but there were moments of great courage. And the pilot of that helicopter and the man in the white shirt leaning down typified that courage. And again in my research, Americans who were there said to me, you know, I don't think I could have lived with myself if I hadn't done something to get these people out. And they still remember the faces of the people they had to leave behind because there wasn't room in the helicopter, because there wasn't room on a boat. And it's never left them, and they're still haunted by it.
What were these Americans, especially the Defense and State Department employees, risking by trying to help the Vietnamese people who worked with them?
Some of them were risking their careers. I tell the story of two young State Department Foreign Service officers who, when they realized that there was no plan to get people they'd worked with, who they assumed were going to be on communist death lists, they went AWOL from their desk jobs. They wore disguises. They met people in the cathedral. It was very cloak and dagger. And after 2 or 3 days, they'd gotten, I think, about 800 people out. At the same time, they had to dodge the State Department security officers who had been cabled from Washington and told to arrest them.
What's extraordinary through your entire story is the degree of insubordination at quite senior levels, people simply refusing to follow orders, forging documents. I mean, how widespread was this?
It was widespread enough so that at the end of the day, in 1 month, 130,000 Vietnamese got out and eventually became American citizens. It was very widespread.
You do describe some outrageously bold moves to save people. Tell us about Al Topping, who, quote, adopted 300 of his Vietnamese staff.
Yeah, Al Topping's a wonderful character. And in fact, I just exchanged some emails with him. He was the Pan Am station manager, one of the first, if not the first, African-American Pan Am station manager. And he was very close to his Vietnamese employees. And there were about 60 of them, but of course, they all had big families. He got permission from Pan Am to get these people out and to get them out on the last plane. But his problem was, how does he get them into the airport? How does he get 340 people past the South Vietnamese police? What he did was he had someone who knew someone at the Ministry of Interior, and they got 343 forms. He signed each one of them showing that he'd adopted not only all of his employees, but all of their family members as well. And he got them all out. He got every single one of them out.
I was moved by your story of diplomat Teresa Tull. She risked her career by telling the truth about the imminent fall of the South and was recalled. And then on the eve of her departure for the US, she had the wife of a South Vietnamese general she worked closely with beg her to take three of their children with her. How many Vietnamese parents made that wrenching decision to send their children away, possibly never to see them again?
A lot did. We were talking earlier about the man in the white shirt helping those people into the helicopter in the famous photograph. He noticed that some of the parents handed in their children and then walked back down the stairs in tears. They had pinned notes onto their children's blouses, and two he remembered. One said, my son wants to be a doctor, and the other said, my daughter is very musical. So these were parents who knew they were probably never going to see their children again. Now, the American Foreign Service officer, Teresa Tull, she was shocked when she read the evacuation plan, the official Pentagon State Department evacuation, and it made absolutely no provision to evacuate any of the South Vietnamese translators, employees at the embassy, people who had essentially put themselves on death lists by working for the United States. So she organized this operation in which Americans would bring their Vietnamese employees and their families in. It was a very brave thing for her to do. There were very few women in the Foreign Service then. And when she was about to leave, General Truong said, will you adopt my children? Will you take my children out? Eventually, General Truong did get out, but she is still incredibly close to these children as if they were her own.
In this case, yes, the family did reunite. But as you mentioned earlier, there are some heartbreaking stories where these US Schindlers, as you describe them, did have to play God, and their decisions clearly affect them to this day. Which of those moved you the most?
I think one is, I talk about an American intelligence officer. He had agreed to ride on one of the evacuation buses that was picking up Americans and Vietnamese who had worked for the United States. Every time they stopped, they were besieged by desperate crowds. They stop, he stands there with his gun, and he lets this woman on. She's on the list. And he looks around, and he sees this young man screaming and waving his arms and running after the bus. And the woman, the last woman who's got on board, screams, that's my brother. Have to stop. The Army intelligence man didn't stop. He said, I was afraid that if we stopped, the bus would be overwhelmed. There'd be a shootout. And when he told me that, 40 years later, he burst into tears. He'd obviously never forgotten. And he had felt responsible for separating this woman from her brother, perhaps forever.
Some of the moving stories in historian Thurston Clark's latest book, Honourable Exit. Well, now to a story about a new language being developed in Australia. Well, a new tech language, at least. A group of Indigenous people in Central Australia were having trouble finding emojis that worked for them. So now they've created their own set. Indimoji have been made for and by Australia's Arunda people. But non-Indigenous Australians are taking to them too, as Oliver Gordon reports.
A Land Cruiser, an enamel mug, boomerangs and a kangaroo tail. These are just a few of the emojis that can now be sent from your phone thanks to Indigimoji.
We included local phenomena, local environmental phenomena and animals.
Arunda man Joel Little worked on the project and says it's about more than just sending better text.
The whole idea was to utilise species that are relevant to this landscape so that it promotes their learning and so that everyone knows the Aboriginal names or the Arunda names for them. And that way everyone stays connected to this culture and this landscape.
The idea came to him as he was writing a message about a year and a half ago.
I was driving along in my car, half writing a message, and I thought about how we use emojis, and I thought, well, why don't we have Arunda emojis? I always think about this stuff because in the digital realm we need to be utilising our languages, we need to be writing and reading in our languages so that they still stay relevant in today's age, and we should be writing text messages and writing essays for school and that in Arunda, and we should be utilising Arunda emojis because it keeps them relevant in today's day and age. And if we utilise them in the digital realm, then it means that they're used daily still.
After coming up with the idea, Joel set about assembling a team to turn the project into a reality. He spoke with elders, artists, designers and researchers and got to work. The 90 characters that made it into the final collection include hand signals, extinct animals, faces, Indigenous crowns and even a woman with a mouthful of chewing tobacco. Artist Emma Stubbs worked on this emoji and found it particularly challenging.
It's a wad of tobacco in your lip that has, it's a native tobacco, and it's high in alkalinity, so it kind of scars your lip and you end up having this persistent pout with a wad of tobacco in your mouth. And a lot of the older ladies walk around with it.
And how did you go about creating or turning that image into an emoji?
I was very specific about how I wanted it to look because I had a family member in mind who I always see with chewing tobacco in her mouth. And so having discussions with Caddy about, no, it needs to be more pouty, it needs to be a bit more pursed, back and forth about how the chewing tobacco, should it sit up on the upper lip or the bottom lip? And so I remember just making these funny faces with Caddy, and it's like this, and like that, and then rolling up things and thinking to myself, is it sitting like that? So yeah, it was very fun to create that emoji.
Caddy Brain, the person Emma was consulting with over her tobacco emoji, has been involved behind the scenes too. It was her job to work out how the team could get their creations into people's phones. In the process, she learnt a lot about the history of emojis and how hard it can be to get in the official set.
So emojis were first actually developed in Japan in 1999. The first set kind of came out, and it was a way of trying to make a cold digital infrastructure feel more emotive. And since then, the emoji set are controlled by an organisation called the Unicode Consortium, who decide which emojis can be in the official set and which can't. They have a committee that makes that decision that is essentially made up of people from really large tech companies. So like so much of the internet, you know, that decision-making lies with a bunch of white dudes in California.
Submitting new emojis to this body can take a lot of resources and many years.
And that was just too long for us, really. We wanted to see that happen much sooner and also just take control, I suppose, of that process. And so decided to make a sticker set instead, which operates a little bit differently to the official emoji set, but you can still be shared and texted and used in social media platforms.
The app has done better than anyone in the team expected. It's had over 30,000 downloads, and already the team behind it are working out how they can do projects with people from different language groups. Artist Emma Stubbs is pleased with its popularity, but even more pleased, the project is achieving what it set out to do.
It's encouraged a lot of people to start using the Arunda language because it's so easy to jump on this app and be proud of it and share it. So it's been, I guess, an amazing thing to see.
How fabulous. That's artist Emma Stubbs, Oliver Gordon reporting, with additional reporting from Janetta Quinn-Bates. And that's all from the World Today team for this week. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely weekend.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.